Amen. I tried to shame Paul into teaching this morning. He wouldn't do it. We really have enjoyed his good preaching the last couple of days. We look forward to another good lesson tonight. Okay, we have come to chapter 12 of Hebrews. We spent two or three classes in chapter 11, just going through and cataloging the people that's listed in that chapter. And quite a few times, you remember, we went back to the end of chapter 10 to see the connection where the writer said, you have need of endurance, or you have need of enduring faith, some versions say. And then those are all examples of what it means to have faith that endures and doesn't quit. Now, God has always wanted that kind of faith in His people. So we went through all those examples. These are the charts that we ended with last time. He mentioned some anonymous saints, did not mention them by name, but we can go back and read some Old Testament accounts. Some, he said, put foreign armies to flight. Some received their dead back by this faith. The prophets did that. Some were tortured, stoned. We mentioned there, 2 Chronicles 24, the son of Jehoiada, who served Joash faithfully, but then when he died, Joash turned a bad corner, if you will. Had his son stoned. Some were sawn in two, not recorded for us in the Scripture, but by tradition it's believed that that was Isaiah the prophet. And the writer concludes this by saying, here's some other examples. In all these servants, the world was not worthy of any of them, how they were treated, mistreated, spitefully abused, and so forth. And the conclusion of that great chapter, we know this chapter 11, 39, and 40, all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised. And the reason why is God had provided something better for us. So the point was not to glorify them or to perfect them, to give them what had always been dreamt of by God for man until the new covenant came. All these were examples before the Messiah came, of course. And this emphasizes God's eternal plan. We looked at Genesis 12, the promise to Abraham, Galatians 3, those passages, and Ephesians 3, the first 12 verses. How that God always had this eternal purpose to redeem man in Christ. And all these saints had to live by faith, and they died not ever seeing that promise. But that's because God had planned something for all mankind, which, of course, is the system in which we live today. So we finished that chapter. And then we also mentioned before we ended, we don't want to miss the bridge or the transition right into this chapter, chapter 12. It's all connected. So now we see chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore, the writer says, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so easily, or easily entangles or ensnares, your version may say, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter, or author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and sat down or is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So that's the first three verses we're going to look at together in this section, bottom of page 32. Now, what I've asked, the first question is, who are these witnesses? Well, it would be the ones we've just talked about in chapter 11. They are there now cheering us on, if you will, this great cloud of witnesses. So, do you have anything in common with these people mentioned in chapter 11? What about Abel? And what about Noah? And what about Abraham? Were they in the New Testament kingdom? They're not in it. They didn't see it come. But are they connected to you in still a real way? They're faithful. They pleased God. They looked to that city. They looked to that kingdom that had been promised by God. So we don't enjoy membership with them in the New Testament kingdom because they never saw it come. But they still tell us, you have need of endurance. We ran our race, and we did it faithfully. We never quit. We endured. We finished the race, and you need to do it too. I've always thought it's helpful to think of these early verses in this chapter as a stadium. All right? I'm going to get too trite here, but their testimony, their witnesses, they testify. And their testimony is the type of faith that God desires in His people, that He's always demanded in His people, whether you're talking about the patriarchal age, the mosaical age, or the gospel age. God's always demanded this kind of faith in His people. That's always been constant, especially relevant when we looked at verses 13 through 16 of chapter 11 and then verse 39, where the author gave those exhortations that we looked at when we went through that chapter. He was waiting for the final age to come, the age of His Son, the age of the Messiah, when all these things could come to fruition. So these witnesses ran their race. Now, let us also, the exhortations, let us run our race. They had to run their race, and they're done, and we have to run our race. Look at the phrase there, to run our race, what are we going to have to do, as the writer says? Here comes Freddie with some copies. Now, if you need a lesson for today, if you'll raise your hand, Freddie will help you get a copy of it. We got some down here, I think, Freddie and Carolyn. Thank you. All right, to run this race, what do we have to do? Well, but to finish the race, what are we told to do? We have to lay aside something. A weight or encumbrance, it's sin. Thank you, Freddie. And what does this sin do according to the author? It easily ensnares or entangles us. That's what sin does. You think it'd be helpful to view sin in this case, trying to build a mental picture here. Sin is a ball and a chain. Well, it's not helpful. It only hinders. I've always thought it helpful to think of this, and I'm a person that's big on mental images. New Testament Christianity is not a sprint. It's not a race that's going to be run quickly. It's a long-distance marathon. You ever watch the Olympics? Every 4 years you see those summer games and the athletic races, track and field events. What about the guy when he wins the 100-meter dash or whatever, however long it is now? 10 meters, I think. No, I think it's 100 meters. 100-yard dash. He's often dubbed the world's fastest man. He covers that in about 10 seconds. Wonder how he'd do in the marathon race. At that speed, he wouldn't. Yeah, he's not been trained for that. He's not equipped to run that. That's not his mode of thinking, and he would soon probably quit. Now, what about the runner who trains for the marathon, 22, 3 miles, whatever it is, long run? What if he were to enter the fast one? Think he'd come in last? I think so. He wouldn't win that race. So we've got to come to the mindset that this thing that we're in, life and running and trying to serve God, it's not going to be over quickly. It's a long distance struggle. And I want to look at these three passages here. This idea, this word for race in Hebrews 12 is the same as these words here. Turn to Philippians 1 verse 30 for me. Philippians 1. Tammy, when you find that, would you read Philippians 1 verse 30? Ralph, if you'll turn to 1 Timothy 6 and verse 12, please. And then Shirley, if you'll turn to 2 Timothy 4 and verse 7. Let's look at three places where this same word is used. It's not the word, it's not translated to race in these other places, but it's the same word in the Greek language. All right, who was my first reader? I forgot. Oh, Tammy. My own wife. Oh, that's awful. Philippians 1, verse 30. All right, Paul says as he finishes that chapter, the same conflict that you saw in me, there's your same word for race, conflict. Now, what do you know about the conflict that Paul had in Philippi? You know anything about that? That's recorded for us in Acts 16. He's in prison. Of course, through all those events, someone came to know the Lord, didn't they? The jailer was converted. But Paul said, now you saw this conflict in me. See, it's a conflict. It's not something that's easy. It's the race. All right? 1 Timothy 6 and verse 12. Ralph, please. All right, now the first word, fight, is the verb. It's a command. You fight. But the second word is the noun, and that's this word, race. Fight the good fight. See, this is a fight. It's a struggle. The devil's not just going to roll over and play dead for us, is he? We're going to have to beat him. We're going to have to struggle mightily against him. And then the third passage, 2 Timothy 4 and verse 7. Shirley, please. Now the word race, I have finished the race. Or some verses say, I finished the course. I believe the Old King James says course. That's not this word here. The word fight is this word. I have fought the good fight. That's the same word. So all these three verses here give us an idea of exactly what the writer is talking about. And wouldn't it be helpful, I think Paul preached on some of this on Sunday, the Lord would have us to come into this thing with what mindset about this race? We're going to have to endure it. At times it's not going to be easy. It's going to be quite challenging. And wouldn't it be helpful to run this race if each of us came to it with this mindset? It's not going to be easy. Now, I know, again, the Bible says the way of the transgressor is hard. I know that. But the Lord also said the straight, narrow way is the more restrictive way to travel, and it's going to be only few that find it, because only few are willing to travel because of its more arduous journey than the one that's wide and wide open. Yes. So they could run better. Right. That's a good point. And when you watch the modern day Olympics now, you see all the. Of course, they just make a big to do out of this sprint, this fast short race, and everybody's got their training regimens and all these things. And the last thing they do, the runners, they will take off their. Now, just forget for the moment their immodesty. We're not talking about immodesty. They're not dressed very good. But they have their track uniform and they take off those warm-up pants. And why do they do that? Let's say that's a hindrance. They remove that so that they can run. That's the image I want us to have in our mind. They remove whatever is going to be in the way. Well, in this race, very plainly now, what does the writer say the hindrance is? Well, it's sin. We're going to have to get rid of that. We cannot have that in our lives and expect to run this race. Well, it won't work. It just will not work at all. So this is such a powerful picture to me. So to finish our race, now that's what we're told to do, but we have an example. Look in verse 2 now. What are we supposed to do as we run this race? Looking to Jesus. Eyes fixed on Jesus. If you remember back in Hebrews 11, when we were looking at Moses, let me find the verse. It will be verse 26. Those three verses together, 24, 25, and 26, when he was dealing with the Pharaoh. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. Remember, we defined that word. I actually read it to you from the lexicon, Mr. Thayer's lexicon, that to look to the reward was to turn the eyes away from all other things and focus, or to look only on one thing. So it wasn't a passing glance, it was a fixed stare. Moses did that. Now this word here in Hebrews 12, this is a different word, but it has essentially the same definition. They may share a common origin with some other Greek word, but the point is, look to Jesus is to look away from all other things, looking only at one thing. So who's your goal? Who's your focus? Who's your pattern? Again, think back to these runners. If you see sometimes they've got like 5 million different camera angles for this race, and they show you the race from all these different aspects. One time I remember, I think it was this past year's Olympics. In 08. And they had a camera, one camera like on every two lanes. There were like 8 or 9, 10 runners there. And one of the second choice favorites, not the guy that was favored to win it, but somebody that thought that maybe could compete with the man who did win it, give him a good run for his money, so to speak. He got about 3/4 of the way down the track, and guess where his eyes went? He looked over here to this guy who was starting to pull ahead. Well, right when he did that, what's that mean? He's done. Where should his eyes have been? Now, the guy who was winning, guess where his eyes never left? That tape out there. He never took his eye off the finish line. And that's what we're told here. What if we turn our gaze away from the Lord in this race? What if we do that? We're going to have some trouble. start looking around at other things. We see this going on over here. We see the supposed success of other people. David wrote a lot about that in the Psalms, didn't he? The wicked and all their prosperity, and we've got this hard life of trying to do good, trying to live righteously, and that just doesn't seem fair to me. We see other people doing other things. We see some of our own brethren quit, fall down, and give up. That can start to have an effect on us, can't it? It could. But the writer says, no, you've got to look to Jesus. That's the only way you're going to win this race. Never take your eyes off Him. Yes, right. Yes, that's why he failed. You are correct. Why he wound up denying the Lord those times. Well, okay. I had the wrong moment in mind. Yes. He looked at the waves around him and he started to sink. That's right. So this idea, I think it's just so important for us to see it. And again, I think the imagery is one of athletics. So he is our example to follow the Lord as he's our goal, he's our aim. He is the author. Some versions say the author or the founder of our faith. That word author or founder means captain. He's the leader. He's the trailblazer. Same word that was used back in chapter 2 and verse 10. And Peter uses the same terminology in Acts 3 and verse 15 in his second gospel sermon, the Lord being our author. He's also the finisher or the perfecter of our faith. And that word means the one who consummates or sets the standard. He's the ideal one. He's the pattern. He bears the standard. And that's how the Lord is portrayed in these early verses. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. So I guess the question you must need to ask and answer is, all right, where are my eyes? Where am I looking? Do I have my gaze set on the Lord? Again, connect it back to the end of 10, all of 11. You have, I have, we have need of endurance. Now, what's the only way we're going to endure? We're going to have to run this race. And you have to run it the way that the writer is telling us here, to succeed and not to quit and fail. We're going to have to keep our eyes on the finish line. So, those are some ideas there about this great conflict of this race that we have in front of us. Well, okay, the Lord said that. Yeah. If you do that, you're not fit for the kingdom. Luke chapter 9. You cannot look back once your hands are on the plow. A lot of similar exhortation we can find in the Bible to make the same great point here. Okay, now, let's look at verse 2 again. The writer says about this author and finisher, this perfecter of our faith. How is he described after he's told to be our founder and perfecter or author and finisher? What's the writer say about him? Okay, and how did he do that, Cornelia? For the joy that was set before him. Some joy is before him. He endured the cross, despising the shame. We're going to talk about these two phrases in a moment. And now he is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. All right. He endured the cross. Are there some things in your life that you endure? You have to endure the length of something. You have to endure the supposed agony of something. Jesus had to endure the cross. How do we know that Jesus was not looking forward to going to the cross? How do we know that? He prayed. What did he pray again? Father, all... I think it's Mark's account that says it the best. Father, all things are possible for thee. Now that means, we know that means, I know you can work this out any other way you want to. You've got the power, the will, the wherewithal to do that. All things are possible for thee. Remove this cup from me. But we know there's no period there at the end of that sentence. In the next breath, what did he say? Yet not what I will, but what thou will do. So Jesus, we know he didn't want to go, so he had to endure the cross. We see that. And so again, this idea, let's not lose sight of the theme, from the end of 10, end of 11, now to 12, we must endure. The writer again said, Hebrews 10 and it's verse 36. For you have need of endurance. We all have need of endurance. We must not quit. Verse 39. We are not those who shrink back to destruction. We're not those that quit. But we are of those who have faith and persevere to the saving of the soul. So he endured the cross. We must endure. Now, I'm sorry. Yes, so many examples. You're right, Cornelius. Abraham, Moses, Noah, they all didn't quit. And that's our example. But of course, the greatest one, obviously, is the Lord. Now, he endured the cross, but what else did he do? Yes. Yes. And we'll bring that up just in a second. You're right. Okay. Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. And then he became perfect. Not before, but after. Now, he despised the shame. What's the shame that he had to despise? What was it, the shame of death? Well, particularly the type of death that he died. And what was so shameful about crucifixion? All right, it was reserved for the most hardened of criminals, the scum of society, so to speak, murderers, thieves, the dregs of the day, so forth. And let's turn to Philippians 2. I think that passage easily comes to mind, and we think about that. Philippians, the second chapter. We at least ought to have Paul read one passage for us while he's here. Sorry about that, brother. Philippians 2. I want you to read for us, please, verses 5 through 8 of Philippians 2. Yes, Paul. What's emphasized at the last part of verse 8? It's not just that he died. But Paul says, the Apostle Paul says, even to that kind of death, even to the shameful, despising death of the cross. Now, we'll come back to verse 9 in a moment because that gets us to the point that he's making here. But for now, we're going to stop right there and make a few other comments before we talk about this joy or this reward, if you will. Yes, Sister Fudge. Yes, ma'am. Same point. Very good. Galatians 3, he became the curse for us being hanged upon the tree. So a lot of other passages we could cite that all make the great point here that the writer is making. He endured the cross. He despised the shame. Now let's talk for a minute about this notion of despising. Usually, and I think this is a safe thing to say, usually the shame of doing something that's not desirable, is that not usually strong enough to keep us from doing it? Because of the shame we would bring upon ourselves for doing it. Like, for example, we're taught about modesty, 1 Timothy 2, to have shamefacedness or shamefastness, that is to be tied or fast to a sense of shame. So I know the main reason why we don't dress immodestly is because we want to please the Lord. And that's a good sermon to preach, but given those actual terms, why do you not go out here and show your nakedness? Because it'd be shameful to do that, and you have such an aversion to bringing shame upon yourself and the Lord whose name you wear, you refrain from that kind of activity. I think that's just a general truth that we could say is so. Well, to despise something means to think little of it. Jesus despised the shame of the cross. He thought little of the shame that would be his by being crucified. Why did he do that? For the joy set before him. That's why he did that. Now, what was the joy set before the Lord? Glory, yes. Being exalted back to his Father's right hand. Doing his Father's will. Obeying his Father. Pleasing his Father. Now, I had Paul quit in verse 8. In Philippians 2. Let's go back there now and pick up verse 9 and just read the verse 9 by itself, Paul, please. That's okay.
That's all right.
The point is clear. God has exalted him. But when did the exaltation come? After. He had to do this first, then he was exalted. Now, let's make the parallel to us. We've got our race to run. We're going to suffer. I doubt we'll suffer like the Lord did. It may come to that someday, but so far I know I have not. But if you want to be exalted, if you want to be rewarded, now, again, Jesus said, he that exalts himself, what? You're going to be abased. We all want to be exalted. That's not the point. The point is, who's going to do the exalting? Am I going to do it to myself, or am I going to let the Lord do it for me? If I'm going to do it myself, I'm going to lose in that matter. It won't be what I want it to be. But if I just bide my time, let the Lord take care of it, my job is just to live in faith, be persevering, endure, the Lord will exalt me. And in due time, the Bible says, in due time He'll exalt us. And that's the point. So Jesus is our example, if you will. He endured the cross, He despised the shame, and He had joy that was set before Him. I've got Ephesians 1:20-23 on the chart. It's very parallel to the verse that Paul just read in Philippians 2 and verse 9. How he was seated at the Father's right hand, far above all principality and power. This is Ephesians 1:21. And might in every name that is named, he put all things under his feet, gave him to be head over all things to the church. Jesus got all of that after he went to the cross. And I'm not saying anything new, but we're just putting all this in its proper context. And that's what the writer is saying here exactly. Now, you're running this race. The writer says, look, you've got to look to your example. Just like those runners fix their eyes on that tape across the finish line, don't take your eyes off Jesus. If our eyes stay on Jesus, we're not going to quit, are we? And that is the whole thing to this book. Again, who's he writing to? What kind of people? Hebrew Christians who were toying with what idea? Of quitting. Going back to the first covenant. And the writer's been pleading and exhorting and making his case in many different ways, but the point has always been the same. You must not go back to that which will not give you what you're in most need of. You've got to stay with Christ. You must stay with Him. You have need of endurance. And today, what do we need to hear? Why do saints quit? They take their eyes off the Lord. That's why. They quit looking to the finish line. They start seeing other things that glamour and glitz and sparkle and, oh, well, maybe that's all right, and maybe that's okay, and it won't work. Say it. Yes, again, that's one of the points that Brother Earnhardt made. When you obey the gospel, that person's done, and I'm dead to those things. Those things now don't have an allurement to me any longer. And to have that kind of mindset takes conviction, and it takes faith, it takes character. And that's why, again, this is a marathon. Is it easy to do that the next day after you're baptized? Well, hardly. You have to learn. You have to grow and mature and deepen in your faith and your knowledge and your conviction. So eventually that's the reward that we get. And it's just that critical. So we have this eternal joy that awaits us. This is a passage that, again, I think he had to keep referencing Brother Earnhardt here, but he's mentioned a lot of these in his sermons. We have this joy that's set before us. And the glory that will be revealed in us, it's far beyond comparison what we have to endure down here. There's just no point of reference at all. They aren't even in the same league. To get through those moments, we're going to have to keep our eyes on the bigger picture. Yes, sir. Go ahead. Problems in this life is not what we're concerned about. It's what's out there that's not going to be desirable for us. So focus is all wrong in that kind of thinking. You're right. Okay, anything else through verse 3? I know we've taken a lot of time on these three verses, but there's so much in these, in his opening exhortation here, that we didn't cover. Anybody have an astute comment that you'd like to make? Okay. Well, and that's the point that we tried to make, is that all that God did to those Old Testament servants was great, it was grand, it was glorious, but it was lacking in one thing. What was it? The promise. God had made that promise long ago, and that system had not yet come. So these people had to just believe and trust. Now, the promise that God's made to us, we may die before we see the Lord come. Okay, that's very possible. Either, you know, Paul says those who are alive and remain will be caught up with the Lord in the air. So that's either going to be our case, or we'll go to sleep and we'll have to wait in the ground until He comes. Either way, though, this defining moment of time in terms of our perspective has come. For them, He had not even been born yet. But now He has, of course, and He's lived and died and been ascended, and now we're living in this side of the cross, as the old saying is, and we're still waiting, but we see the completed picture now, whereas they hadn't even seen Him come yet. And that's the difference in the point of references there. So it's just it's a great encouragement to us when we look at these Old Testament servants as they're held up for us, if you will, in that chapter. But now we see our perspective from the other side of the cross, and we see how it all fits together. It's just a great strong point to make. Okay, so verse 3 says we must consider Jesus. We compare what He did to how we face our challenges. He endured, He did not quit. And that's what we must do. We must endure, not quit. We must not grow weary or be faint-hearted. I don't want to sound too redundant here, but that's really the theme of this juncture of the letter as he writes to these Hebrew Christians. Okay. Now, we go from that to verse 4. He now speaks, and this gets us to middle of page 33, question 8. The point of verse 4, he gets a little more specific now, a little more direct in his addressing of these issues. Let's talk about the value of discipline. Most of us here are parents or grandparents. What do you know about discipline from your perspective now? What do you know about it? It's good. It's good. Well, why is it good? It turns somebody around who's misbehaving. You see conduct or behavior, then that's not acceptable. That's not appropriate to the standard that's been set. And so you stepped over the line there, you're going to have to be corrected. It may be the withholding of a privilege, or it may be a whooping, as they say down here. You may get spanked. You may have to have some corporal pain put on you so that you realize that's not good. Now, take a step back in time when you were the young person. What did you think about it? I didn't like that. Remember the old phrase your daddy said now, it's going to hurt you worse than it's going to hurt me. Or no, it's going to hurt me. I said that backwards. Now, let me try that again. It's going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. And what did you think when you heard that? That is not so. That's false. That's misinformation. Well, but see, your perspective now, that was true, wasn't it? Because of your love for the child. We don't take any joy in disciplining. But we know it's needful at times because of different situations that our children find themselves in. Okay. And he makes some points about discipline here in this section, talking about earthly fathers. And, of course, the grand point here is about our Heavenly Father. That's the idea he's talking about here. Now, what about these Hebrew Christians? What did he say about them in verse 4? All right. You have not yet resisted, or my verse says you have, in your struggle against sin. Again, this is the English Standard Version. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Now, right now, when you read that sentence, who does your mind go to? Who had he just talked about? Christ shed His blood. But now, you've not struggled that mightily yet. I don't think he's trying to demean them or to put them down just to give them a dose of reality. All right? Jesus went all the way with it. He is the example. He's the standard. But yet you've not gone that far. Now, had they suffered? Had these people he's actually writing to, not us, but them, actually, had they suffered? Go back to chapter 10. We just went through this not long ago. Let's look in verses 32. Start at verse 32. Freddie, read 32 through 35, please. So, personally, how had they suffered? Two ways. We made mention when we went through that text. Look, especially in verse 33. They suffered two ways. They suffered themselves, partly because you were exposed publicly to reproach and affliction. What's the other way they suffered? Because they were companions of those who were mistreated, so they suffered that way too. They had association with one another. And so the idea of guilt by association. So they had suffered. In fact, and in verse 34, what particularly had they suffered? Well, bonds and the plunder or the loss of what? Their property. And notice also, how did they receive that? They joyfully accepted the plunder of their property. Somebody comes to you today and says, "You've got to get. We're going to take your house because you're a Christian. You lose your land, you lose your house, you lose it all." Well, they took that joyfully. So they had suffered. But now the writer says, he brings them back again to this notion of the example of Christ. Well, yes, I know you've suffered, but you've not yet resisted against sin to the point of bloodshed. It's not gone that far. It can go that far, but so far it has not happened to you in that way. So they had apparently forgotten an earlier admonition, the writer says now. Verse 5. And have you forgotten? Some versions have it in the form of a question. Or you have forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons. Well, what is the exhortation? The last part of verse 5 into verse 6. It's a quotation from Proverbs 3, verses 11 and 12. What is it? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline or the chastisement of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by Him. For the Lord disciplines the one He loves and chastises every son whom He receives. Now let's think about this a minute. Is the writer saying that how they have suffered, though he says again, you've not gone to the point of shedding your blood, but how they have suffered. Is the writer saying that's from the Lord? Is he calling it the discipline from the Lord? Do we know if it was that? Can we say with certainty it was? I don't think we can say with certainty. But can we say it wasn't? My question is, the reason I'm asking this is, why would he bring this in now if it was not at least a possibility? The Lord loves those whom, the Lord chastens those whom He loves. Could the reason for the trouble they're suffering that's giving them cause to go back to, or to want to go back to that inferior covenant, could that be from the Lord? Could it be chastisement? Could it be discipline? Could be. Sometimes doesn't God need to get our attention? Maybe if we're not living like we ought to, if we're not as faithful or enduring as we need to be, and God sometimes has to get our attention. And God has so many things at His disposal. Could He not use suffering, if you will, to cause us to rethink where we are, who we are, what we're doing, and say, "Now wait a minute, what am I involved here? Maybe I need to take stock in myself again and reevaluate where I am. Maybe I'm not where I need to be." All that's possible. He allowed Job to suffer, didn't he? He wasn't the cause of it, but he allowed it to happen. He had confidence in Job. You look like you're thoughtful. You want to say something?
Well, I think that's what I was saying. I think God could do that. In this context, the patient comes to you because you are following Christ. That was the case that they were back in the way of it. Not in the back of the old covenant. They had escaped them.
Would that be seen, though, as still as chastening from the Lord? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
He suffered for his sake.
Right.
He could forget that. He could put a canopy around him when he didn't have that, but it could destroy him.
Right.
We have to suffer to be purified. We have to suffer to be saved. We have to suffer so our faith.
I understand. Yes. Yeah, and we don't want to fault the Lord for that. That's not, we're not blaming Him, but we're just saying He uses those things under His control to get us to be more aware of what our responsibilities are. I appreciate that point. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe. Possibly. I never thought about that. If you didn't hear what Freddie said, if these were Hebrew Christians, and they were, I mean, these were saints, and they were toying with going back to an inferior covenant, which was clearly would be the wrong thing to do, Freddie's question and his point is, could this not be church discipline that would be being brought upon them? That would be from the Lord, would be a chastening of or from the Lord to get them to not do that. That's a valid point to think about also. Right. Yes. Right. It's all from the Lord. And again, what Paul said, I want to echo what I said. We're not blaming God for any of this. That God's just using. He allowed these things to happen to bring about the fruit in His child that needs to be there. Of course, God would rather us not need to be disciplined, obviously. That's the ideal thing. But if we have yielded in some way, we need to be brought back. So his point now, this after quoting this proverb, it is for discipline that you have to endure. Verse 7, God is treating you as sons. What son is there whom his father does not discipline? Well, what about the old adage the parent says, well, I just love my child too much to whip him or spank him. What about that? You don't love your child then. You do not do what you claim. You do not love that child. Because the person that does not, or the parent that does not bring about some punishment or some, albeit some pain upon their child, just let them live any old way they want to, you don't love that child. Not at all. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The answer is not just because, well, that's just what we do. Why do we not have a piano up here? Somebody says, well, we just don't have one. That's just not the way we do things in the Lord's church. And that's all we say. Well, that's not really teaching. We must have a teaching or disciplining or discipling would all be similar ideas. So God disciplines His children to show love, not to cause them to quit. We don't bring about some of this corporal punishment to further have our children dig their heels in and rebel even more. We do it to to help them see the wisdom of stopping what they're doing so that they won't continue on that path anymore. So this writer is saying here in these verses now that you have to be disciplined. It is for discipline that you have to endure. You're being treated as sons. Now, verse 8. What if you are left without discipline? What if God was that parent that says, I love you too much, and there'll never be a father who loves children more than God? He's the example of love. What if God was that kind of father? I love you all too much to punish you. Well, what if you're left without discipline, in which all have participated? What's the writer say? You're illegitimate. The old King James says you are bastards. Not a legitimate child. And God won't have that. He wants to legitimize us, if you will. So then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Verse 9, besides this, now his point is, and surely if we can understand this, we can understand the point that he's making. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we did what? We respected them. Now, that happens when in your life? That you respect your parents for a hard stance they took. After you get older. My dad was hard. Now, he was hard on me. And there was many a night I was mad at him, as mad as I could be. But now, looking back, and I see some of my own parental failures, I see why he was that way. And I love and appreciate him for that. So, the writer says, we respected them because of the tough stand they took in matters of discipline. Look at his question toward the end there of verse 9. Shall we not what? If we respected our earthly fathers, which we should, then what's his question? You're awful quiet today. Okay. He says, shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits, the Heavenly Father, and live? Shouldn't that be what we're thinking? That's his question. For they, that is our earthly fathers, this is verse 10, for they disciplined us for a short time. That is to say, this life is not eternal. It's just a window. They disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to the child. No, to the parent. It seemed best to them. But He, God, disciplines us for our good. Why? Now, this phrase is critical. Why does God do it? He wants us to share in His holiness. We may be partakers of the divine nature. We may borrow from another passage. That's what God wants. That's why God disciplines. He wants to make us better. He wants to make us whole. And He allows things to happen so that we'll not quit. Get our attention. And it may be that we suffer for taking a stand for the cross of Christ, as Paul makes his point, and I would certainly agree with that. But even if that or not is not the case, and God still must get our attention, why is He doing that? Why does He allow that to happen? Well, we got one or two ways to respond to that. If it's God bringing some kind of misfortune or allowing something to come upon us, what does the majority of people do? They'll blame God. Get mad, become bitter, quit. That's the thing. They'll quit. That's one response. The other response is receive it, realize the benefit of it, know that it's possibly coming from my Father who loves me and I can do better. It's a great lesson. One that we need to think about all the time. So I've gotten ahead of my charts here. Discipline isn't a sign of divine disapproval. In fact, is this not one of the atheists' main arguments? What does he say? Look at all the cancer and the death and the destruction. You going to tell me this is a sign of a loving God? That's what they say. Well, that's not the sign of an unloving father who disapproves. That is a sign of a father that loves us. Discipline reveals God's care and establishes the father-child relationship and helps us develop our character. Count it all joy, my brethren, when you fall into diverse trials. Why? What does James say? Why do we need to count it all joy? What does that do? What do those trials do? It brings character. It builds faith and conviction, determination. But it's going to take a thinking person. It's going to take a spiritually thinking, not a flighty little bird out here flying around. It's going to take somebody who's got some thought and some purpose and some conviction to see that truth. That's got to be us. And that kind of person won't quit. He'll have his ups and his downs, but he won't quit. He won't go back to that from which he came from, where he's been bought and where he's been redeemed. Okay. Now let's look at verses 7 through 10. We've already read through some of these. But look at these points. What we're calling the purpose for discipline. It makes our endurance possible. We see that from verse 7. It is for discipline that you have need to endure. Verse 8, it legitimizes us as God's children. That's what discipline does. Makes us not illegitimate, the writer says. It causes us to respect God as our Father. And his point of reference is, well, you respected your earthly fathers and they were hard on you at times, so this ought to cause you to respect God even more. Because he's the Father of spirits. And we get life from him. And then in verse 10, the purpose of discipline is to allow us to share in his holiness, to be a part of him, to be partaker of him in this grand scheme that he's got in mind for us. All right. Anything through verse 10, a comment anybody would like to make? I'm doing all the talking. I don't want to do that. Got it all covered then, right? Okay. Now let's look at verse 11. We had just a couple of minutes left. Discipline may seem unpleasant. Look at his point there in verse 11. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. Well, you get to... In fact, I know I've said this on more than one occasion when I spanked one of my children. For some reason, and I can't figure out why, but my kids would have rather had my wife spank them than me. I wonder why. Now, she can whip pretty good too. But more than one occasion when we got done, and one of our kids would say, you know, that didn't feel too good. That kind of hurt. You know what I always said? It's supposed to. This isn't a hug. This is supposed to get your attention. The writer says, discipline may seem unpleasant. In fact, he says there, this version, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. But what's his point? That's not really his point. What's his point? What does it do? What does discipline do based on verse 11? All right, see, we're after fruit. We want this corrective action to yield some fruit. It yields, he says, the peaceful fruit of righteousness. And does that happen to everybody? Based on verse 11? No. It only will yield fruit to who? Those who've been trained by. Now, I've heard some parents say, and I know you have also, maybe you even said it yourself, you know, I've beat that boy black and blue, and he never changes. He's just as stubborn as a mule. No change. We've tried this, we've tried that, we can't get through to him. And sometimes that's a struggle. So sometimes some are not trained by discipline. They're just not trained by it. They're unyielding, and they will not give in to that. But by and large, if you get a hold of, a child good enough, and you get through to him or her, this is not going to be tolerated. This cannot be allowed to go on, and there's going to be consequences for your misbehavior. And there is training that comes from that. Then they'll yield. They'll bend the will, if you will. And the writer says here, that's what God may be doing to you. If he loves you, that's what he's doing. And he wants you to be trained by it. Your discipline, if you will. Okay. I really don't have time to finish these five verses or these six verses, and this is probably as good a place to stop as any. So the Lord willing, next Tuesday we'll pick up. This gets us to the top of page 30. Well, it'll be question 13 on page 34, and it'll be Hebrews 12 and verse 12. And so now you have the next lesson, also lesson 10. Go ahead and finish this one and then complete lesson 10 also. We'll pick up our discussion there next time. Thank you for your good comments and your participation today.